I'm Marcy, and I'm an alcoholic. Sam, thank you for asking me to come out. I love the ride out here. It's a really beautiful ride, and every time I come out, I say, I'm going to come out again when I'm not asked to be the speaker, and then I never do. So anyway, my sobriety date's April 17th, 1995, and I have a sponsor, and I talk to her on Friday. And I do have a home group, and I do get to sponsor other women, and I am always shocked when, every time I say my sobriety date, I shouldn't say I'm shocked, but I'm just so deeply grateful. I can't believe that I've stayed sober. That does shock me that I have stayed sober, that I've gotten to be sober. But I really did not believe I was an alcoholic. I came to you when I was 20 years old, so I'm 38. I've been sober 18 years, and I looked around and I saw people that were much older than you are tonight and about the age that I am. And I thought, you know, I don't belong here with these old people. And I really believed what made me an alcoholic was what I thought I heard you say in meetings. And that's that you'd lost some homes and you lost some cars and you lost custody of children and you'd lost relationships and marriages even and jobs and careers. And I never lost any of that. I still haven't lost any of those things. I never had them when I was drinking, but I really believed that because I had never lost those, that was why I was not an alcoholic. And it was very difficult for me to listen to what an alcoholic is. And what I have found an alcoholic is that when I start drinking, I don't know what's going to happen. I have no idea. Sometimes I have four and I'm in a blackout. Sometimes I have 18 and I'm so sober and it's so frustrating because I really wanted the release from the escape and that didn't hit me. And I'm on my 18th drink, whether it's beer or vanilla extract shots or whatever it was that I was drinking that night, and I'm not drunk. And also what would happen is I would have these bizarre interactions while I was drinking that would put me in a position that would say, I'm not going to have that kind of consequence again. One of those was I was with my older cousin at my other older cousin's wedding. For what it's worth, I'm one of 10, and my mom is one of 8, and I was raised by my aunt and uncle. So my aunt is one of 8. My uncle is my biological mother's brother, and there are 3 of them. And then I have a biological father, and it's just him and his sister. But I don't even know how many cousins I have, and it's very confusing because my aunt is the youngest in her family. So her older sister started having kids when my aunt was a little girl. So I have cousins that are like my mama's age. I call my aunt my mama. So, and then the fact that there are 10 of us, and I have no true biological siblings. Family has always been really difficult for me, and it's always been this, when people ask about how many brothers and sisters I have, that's been like this area of, I'm different than you. And so anyway, my cousin, my aunt and uncles, nieces and nephews, I call them all cousins, and her brothers and sisters are my aunts and uncles. So at one of those weddings, one of their other cousins, and we were getting drunk, and drinking gin followed by Donald Duck orange juice. And I got so sick. I mean, just sick. And I have never touched gin or Donald Duck orange juice. And that's the logic. That really depicts for me the logic of an alcoholic. I've heard so many people share their stories about how these weird things happen, so they never had cold Pabst Blue Ribbon or whatever it was again. And that's me. It never occurred to me that it was the way I drank and the amount that I drank. And I started drinking when I was very young. I was 8 years old. I had just moved in with my aunt and uncle. Child Protective Services placed me in protective custody, and my aunt and uncle stepped up to take that custody so my older brother and sister and I wouldn't be in and out of foster homes. And here's what I know about children of turbulence. When things calm down, and I've watched this with the women I sponsor, things will be really hairy, and that first year of recovery is hell. the kids are worse than during the last days of drinking, from what I've seen. And now that may not be blanket, and it may not be your experience. I don't have children, so I have no experience with that, but that's just what I've seen, that it is worse when mom gets sober than it was when she was drinking. And then it calms down is the hope, and things get really nice and pleasant, but that first year is torture. And I understand that. When things calmed down for me and I moved in with my aunt and uncle and I knew where my meals were coming from and there was consistency, I couldn't put it in these terms as an 8-year-old. But looking back on it, that was more upsetting than not knowing, than going to bed hungry or wearing the same clothes for 3 or 4 days or something like that. That I can tell you horror stories, but when it became consistent, with hindsight, it was far more upsetting. So I started drinking with my older cousin, who I now call my older brother, my other older cousin, who's now also my other older brother, and a good friend of ours, Thomas Pisani. And I'll tell you a story about all four of us. I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1995. My older cousin, Chris, got clean in Narcotics Anonymous in 1989. My older sister, Joy, she was touched and saved in the church in 1995. And Thomas, I saw for the first time in 13 years about 3 months ago. And he's the walking dead. He just can't find us and stay here with us. So those are the folks that I started drinking with. My drinking didn't improve from there at all. I have no experience with falling up the ladder of success. It still kind of irritates me when I hear people talking about their military careers, and it just gets better and better the longer they drink, or some other career, and they just talk about how somehow they just accidentally kept finding themselves in better and better career positions. That's not my experience. I'm a poster child for alcoholic. People who say, if I ever end up like that, I'll know I'm an alcoholic. That's how I ended up, and I knew I didn't belong here with you. Because, and this is what this is part of what's so amazing to me about the alcoholic mind, is no matter what the circumstances, I will separate myself from you. I have heard dozens of people describe, well, if I ever drank out of a brown paper bag, was homeless, see, that's an alcoholic. And I that's how I was. I lived under the Lee Street Bridge for the last 9 months of my drinking. And I didn't drink out of a brown paper bag except on really fancy days. Typically, it was rubbing alcohol or vanilla extract. Not because I'm like some awful low-bottom drunk. I'm just lazy, and it's hard to buy alcohol underage. It's far easier to buy rubbing alcohol or vanilla extract. That's really the only reason. But I didn't believe I belonged here with you because I had come in and I'd visited you in the past because my brother had gotten clean in Narcotics Anonymous. And when I'd visited you, I knew that we weren't alike at all. Because you're just like you are tonight. You're clean, you're well put together, and you enunciate. And that's not, I had not bathed, the last part of my drinking I didn't bathe except for maybe once or twice a year. A year. I'm not saying like a month or a week. A year. I understand when they talk about dangerously antisocial. I get that. And what's really weird is I didn't for a little bit. I didn't even start bathing for a year and a half after I got sober, because it just didn't occur to me how weird that was. And it was a little upsetting to me when I got my 2-year medallion and my sponsor was talking about, we tell stories at my home group, and she said, yeah, we're real excited that Marcy started bathing. And I was like, what are you talking about? Why would you tell people that stuff? I mean, so, I'm just very sensitive. But it's weird to me just how bizarre my life was, but it was acceptable and it was okay. And I had been here to visit you, and I knew I didn't belong here with you. And I like to hang out with people that are more extreme than I am. Because then there's no reason for why I'm acting the way that I'm acting, because clearly they're worse. So I have a lot of experience with drugs, because typically my experience shows that folks who do drugs are more extreme than folks who keep it to just drinking. It's not always the truth. I've sponsored a tremendous amount of women that never did any drugs, and their drinking was very scary and out of control. But one of the gals that I hung out with in the end of my drinking, I don't mind doing drugs. I'll tell you this. I don't mind doing drugs that'll keep me drinking longer, or that when I stop, put me in a position that the only way to get through the sickness of being off of that drug is to drink, and drink excessively, preferably to stay in a blackout for 3 or 4 days. And to me, I had a hierarchy. And there were certain people that did certain drugs that were just scum of the earth. That's just what I believed, because I can't be the same as you. So, and I tell you, when I came here and I was willing to do what you asked me to do, one of the biggest obstacles for me was, at the same time, I was worse than you, and you were worse than me at the exact same time. So I had these folks that certain drugs are just scum of the earth, and that those are the people that I was hanging out with. And it's not that I was hanging out with scum. That's not that. What was so upsetting to me is that my beliefs around who I was hanging out with and what I was doing did not fit at all and were unacceptable. That's what I finally have come to see in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not how many houses I robbed or people. It's when I'm engaging in activity willingly, and in some cases encouraging that activity, and it goes against everything I believe in. And I make up lies. I am somebody who makes up lies to say, this is why I'm engaging in that activity. And to live like that for me is miserable, whether I'm drinking or sober. I've done that sober too, where I'm engaging in activity that I just don't believe in, and telling myself lies for why I'm engaging in it, so that way it'll try to be acceptable. And this gal, she told me that she was going to get clean, which in my mind had always meant we're not going to drink. Or excuse me, we're not going to do drugs, we will drink. And that's, I kind of like helping people do that. I do. Because then we can go and drink, because we're clean now. And what's really great to me about my experience is that it wasn't something that we just could go and do. And the spiritual life I have found is very simple. And this was an extremely complicated process. Not only were we going to get clean, but we had to do that in Florida, because for some reason there was just there was no availability to do that in Richmond, Virginia. I mean, which is so bizarre. So we drive to Florida, which I like to do because I didn't drive. In fact, I was 2 years sober when I got my driver's license, and somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous gave me a car. That 2 years later, Chip said, I can't believe that car is still running. I'm like, I know. But I had that car for 2 years. But I didn't drive. So, and I lived in the fan in Richmond. And I lived, the only place that I went was like maybe a 5 mile radius. And I rode my bicycle wherever, or I'd walk, or I'd ride the city bus. But I just, going out to the county was terrifying to me, because the buses left the county at 10 p.m., so if you weren't together, then you were left out in the county, and it's like a huge spotlight if you don't have somewhere to stay when you're out in the county. So it was always terrifying to me to be out in the county, because I didn't want to literally miss the bus. So my girlfriend, we're going to Florida, and something great happened. One of the things is the guy that we were staying with was a guy. I don't know if I would have gotten out of the car had it been a female. I am so grateful to the men of Alcoholics Anonymous that when I was new, talked to me, but directed me to the woman. And I'm so glad that you didn't turn on your heels and walk away. Because I don't, maybe I would be here, I don't know. But it's so important to me that I do talk with new people. But with you guys, I help you find a solid man. And we're so funny, because I didn't relate to women, so I mean, I clearly have to talk to the guys, and so I played that little game, but he didn't play that game, and he introduced me. He did a phenomenal 12-step. Since I've read the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've seen how you 12-step someone, that's exactly what he did. He talked to me about his drinking. He asked me questions about my own drinking, and when I told him it wasn't that bad, he asked me about what that meant. And he asked me about if I'd ever tried to quit, and I hadn't. And I've talked to a dozen alcoholics that haven't ever. You ask them about trying to quit, and they're like, nope. But then you start talking a little bit more, And we all have tried it, but again, in order to live the life I'm living, I can't tell myself that truth. So I come up with a lie. And just a phenomenal 12-step described to me a relationship with his creator and the possibility that I could have that right as I was right then. And that was very attractive to me. I was raised Catholic by my aunt and uncle, and I have not had the experience I hear some people in Alcoholics Anonymous talk about. And I'll tell you this, I am saddened when I hear somebody say I'm a recovering Catholic or something. Just like many, many of the organized religions have given purpose and direction, and my family has a very strong purpose and a strong direction, and it looks to me as if it comes as a direct result from their faith that they have found in that church. So I just was very complacent about it, honestly. So when he talked to me about a personal relationship with a creator, that was new. I'm positive we talked about it growing up. I just don't remember that, that it just isn't part of my experience of what I remember. And so I was really excited, and 30 days later, I drank again. I didn't do anything you do here. I didn't come to any of your silly little meetings, nothing. But I really wanted to be here, and I knew I needed to be here. I knew my life needed to be different. In those 30 days, I had gotten a job with my Social Security number, so my that money was going to my Social Security, which had never happened before. I didn't exist on paper up until that point. I filed where I actually lived, so with my job, so my job knew where I actually lived. And I had started talking to my biological father, who 3 years earlier I'd conned him into letting me live with him. And then I went out one night and I left him a note because I'm very considerate. And it said, went out, be back later. And then 3 years later, when I was sober for those 30 days, is when I reestablished that relationship. Because there are several lies that I have believed, but one of them has been, I'm only hurting myself. Leave me alone. Just get off my back. If you just leave me be and let me do what I want to do, it'd be fine. I don't know why you're so on my case. This doesn't concern you. And 30 days later, I drank. And I called Francis, and I said, Francis, who's the guy that I went to Florida with, I said, you need to take me to a meeting. She said, no, I don't. She was dead right. I had no idea how to ask for help. I know how to demand things, but I had no idea how to ask for help. And I don't know what would have happened had the conversation gone differently, but what I do know is as a result of that conversation, what I learned is how to start asking for help, and I also learned there's nothing you can do to keep me from sobriety when I'm ready to be here. Nothing. Because she told me where there was an AA meeting, and it was about 12 miles from where I lived, and so I rode my bicycle down there to that AA meeting because she wasn't going to take me. And I found out years later that it was because she was just being a pill. But it doesn't matter because I got a great experience. And that's what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that even if you are being a pill, if we're on this path together, that we will both learn and grow. And it's okay. We're protected. There's really no harm to be done. Sure, we cause harm and we cause a ruckus, but it can, anyway, trying to explain that one's a little crazy. So I went to that AA meeting, and they gave out the chips beforehand, and I picked up a weight chip, and then you guys started clapping, and I thought, you bunch of jerks. Because clearly you're clapping because you think that it's so nice that I'm suffering the way I'm suffering. And you have no idea what it's like to suffer the way I'm suffering. And I hate you for it. I mean, I was so angry when you guys clapped when I picked up that weight chip because I was just crying and embarrassed and felt just utterly defeated. And I really, if I could have stood in front of you long enough, I probably would have punched you in the face. But I couldn't because I was so angry with you, but I couldn't. I knew you were so much better than me, but I also knew, just like I described, that you were just so much worse than me because if you were compassionate at all, you wouldn't have been clapping in the first place. So then you invited me out to coffee and I went, which is what I have come to believe is grace. because I did not want to go. I didn't want to be near you. I was so mad at you, so hurt by you, I was so offended by you because you clapped when I picked up a white chip. But you invited me to coffee and I went. And my entire life changed. Everything changed. But not without a lot. I like how they describe it in our literature, that we're given all these promises and then it says a price has to be paid. And then destruction of self-centeredness. And that that's a big price to pay when you're somebody as egotistical as myself. And I already know. And if I don't know, then I'll play dumb until I can back you into a corner and then walk away. And which may have been useful a few years ago, but it's becoming less and less useful as the time goes on. So I picked a sponsor out of the crowd. It was just, you might as well put a list of names in a basket and shuffled them up, and that was pretty much how I picked my sponsor 18 years ago. And it's not somebody I related to. I picked her, at the meeting that I went to, they said, raise your hand if you can be a sponsor. Women stick with the women, men with the men. And my sponsor, Valerie, was one of the women that raised her hand, and I went up to talk to her about being a sponsor. Really, I interviewed her because clearly I know what I need. And I asked her questions about how she worked the steps because I had gone cross-country for 9 months with Alan and Francis, and so I've been exposed to some real AA instead of that Podunk Richmond AA. I'm just so arrogant. So here I am asking somebody for help and then interviewing her at the exact same time. I love that that saying, we are people who look down on others while we're in the ditch. I mean, that describes me perfectly. I'm just so arrogant. So I knew that I wanted a sponsor, and so she agreed to be my sponsor, and we started walking through the steps together. And I really, at my heart, did not believe I was an alcoholic. I went through the steps, and I questioned it, and I would ask her questions and just ask her questions. And at a year and a half sober, I'd gone through the steps. I'd written an inventory. I'd read it to her. I'd made some real hard amends. I'd sat with that inventory prior to making those amends and looked at my character defects, and I wrote a list of the people I'd harmed and what exactly I owed them amends for. And I, like I said, I made some of those hard amends, started sitting in prayer, trying to work with other people. And I really, there was this part of me that's like, I'm not an alcoholic. See, there was that one time I drank too and I got up and I walked away. Alcoholics don't do that. And I did that one time. But what's great is I just kept talking to her about it. And at one point, there's a part in our book that says, if you're still not convinced, try some controlled drinking. Now, it doesn't say that when you walk in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, hey, I'm not sure I'm an alcoholic or not. Well, that's all right, chap, go try some controlled drinking. That's not what I'm talking about. It's we'd walk through all of the steps. And I really wasn't sure I was an alcoholic. I really, at my core, there was doubt. And so I told her I was going to drink again. Not because because I really wanted to know if I was an alcoholic or not. So my brother invited me out to lunch, and I had been going to eat in bars since I got sober because there are restaurants during the day and bars at night. So, and I just started cooking like 2 years ago. So in order to eat, you got to go to a bar. It wasn't like that was going to be a trigger, because honestly, oxygen is my biggest trigger, or my eyes being open. I mean, so my brother and I, my oldest brother and I, go to a bar, and I go to order a Black Russian. And then I thought, you know, that's when you're a punk street kid. Now you're a lady. Because that's what I drank when I was being real fancy, and when I really thought I could con you into buying my bar tab, I put those on it. And so I thought, well, I'll order some wine. And I, to this day, know nothing about wine. The way I judge a good wine is, now I've learned to ask the clerk if I need to buy it for my family member or something. But the way I judged it up until, well, anyway, was the higher the proof, the better the wine. And they just don't list proof on the menus. So I'm like, I just don't know what to order. So I ordered a coffee and water. And then I ordered my meal. And I remember exactly what I ate. It was a black bean burrito with cheddar cheese. and sour cream, and I ate that. My brother and I walked out to the parking lot, and I thought, I didn't drink. And it wasn't this thought of gratitude. It was, Mother, damn it. And I was going to drink because he was going to buy it. He was buying my lunch. And the next thought was, you have no control. You make up your mind to drink and you don't drink. You make up your mind not to drink and you drink. You have no control. You are absolutely an alcoholic. And I am so grateful for that experience. I know at my core, I am an alcoholic. And I am a far more effective sponsor because I know my truth. I know exactly who and what I am. I am not somebody who suffers from the from not having been raised by my biological parents. I really thought that was my problem for a long, long time. And I love talking with alcoholics because, you see, you don't understand. It's one of our great war cries is, I'm asking you for help. And then I'll tell you how you clearly don't understand. You don't understand, Valerie, what it's like to not have been raised by your parents. I mean, I never even drank legally. You don't understand what that's like, woman. And you don't, but will you help me? Will you help me? Please? It's so foolish. So I just started being able to really sponsor women. And that was when I was a year and a half sober. I got driver's license and a car was given to me at 2 years sober. Started bathing more regularly around that point. And just really started to get in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Got to meet some wonderful people, and it's so nice because I one of the very first big book study I ever went to was with Randy out in the country of Richmond, in the Richmond country, not the Madison country. And it was just it's just remarkable to me to have history with people because I didn't even live with my parents for, 8 years, and then I went and moved in with my aunt and uncle, and I've just never had the experience of maintaining relationships with people, and you've given me that gift. So I started going through the steps and making different amends and going back into these relationships with people that had really, I had this score chart, and people, there were some people that had done me dirty, I mean really dirty. My father was at the top of that list, and because any good and decent man raises his children. And I finally came to a point of peace with that, that my point of peace is parenthood brings out the very best in people. I have never, and I've talked to women that are incarcerated for committing crimes against their babies, but I know at the depth of my being that that was the best that they could bring to the table. And I know that absolutely to be the case with both of my parents, that they had some difficulties and they still have some difficulties, but that was absolutely the best that they can bring to the table. And my father and I, we made peace. And then recently he got into a car accident. We started riding motorcycles together, and he was on a trike and rear-ended the back of a car and flew over the car, and it was pretty bad. And he was down at MCV for a little while, and I went back to his house. My husband went back to his house to check on some things, and the condition of his house was just awful. And I lost my cookies. I'm like, what are you doing? And I got to see, I talked to my uncle. I said, Papa, this is the same kind of crap that that the house was in when I moved out. That's why we moved out, was because the house looked like this. It was just so much debris that there was really just a pathway throughout the house. And I could not calm down from it. I was so angry. And I don't know if it's because, if it would have been like that in of itself, but a month earlier, my younger brother had passed away. I don't know if it's he could not or he would not. I don't know what it is for him, but he was unable to get sober, which makes no sense to me, even today, because he has the strong example of my older brother who's been clean in Narcotics Anonymous 24 years. I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous 18 years, and my sister's been very active in the church for 18 years. So even if he was like, look, AA is trashy, he had two other places where he could, and he just was not able to, and he would move around, and he's like, I'm gonna move up to Orange, where nobody knows me, and I don't have anybody saying, what about Marcy, and what about Pooh Bear? So then that night, I get this call, Mars, yeah, bro, you know so-and-so and so-and-so? You know Lynn Hill and Billy? Yes, I do. Well, they know you. I'm like, yeah, I thought you were up there to get away from everyone and to get away from your name. What are you doing? He loved to drop names, and if he could have gotten clean through osmosis, he would have. He absolutely, you just can't do that. So on the after my brother dies, I find this out about my father, and I had been through some times that were dark, and they were brought on me, by me. When I was 5 years sober, it was very, very difficult. I just had a hard time. I love the description in our book about We Agnostics, that making that jump from bridge to shore, that I don't hold on. I wrap all my limbs around the handrail of reason, because reason is the ultimate. And if it's not reasonable, then we just shouldn't be engaging in it. When really, I've had the most fun in my life doing things that make no sense, and it's been absolutely the right thing. And I had a really difficult time at 15 years sober. I wanted to, for real, fire my sponsor, and I just could not. There was the transition to growing up and to just, I don't know if it's because I got sober young or maybe it happens to everyone around that 15-year mark, but it was just so hard to let go of what I thought she wanted me to be and look to what my creator might want me to be. And because what would happen is I would hate her and then desperately want her approval in the exact same time, in the exact same space. And that is completely impossible. And if it weren't for the loving women in Alcoholics Anonymous, I called one woman and I said, Allison, will you be my sponsor? And she said, nope, but I'll walk with you through this, but I won't sponsor you. I believe that saved my life, because I would have just jumped from doing that to Valerie to doing that to Allison and never walked through it. And I'm so grateful that I've continued this relationship with my sponsor that I truly believe is divine. I do. There's no other reason why a woman who I pick out of a hat has been my greatest mentor for the last 18 years. That's what I'm saying. I've had the most fun when I engage in activity that make no sense to me. So at 18 years sober, I'm just dying, and I'm like, this isn't right, because the other times I've walked through this, it's been a self-imposed crisis that I couldn't postpone and I couldn't evade. And that's not what's happening right now. My little brother dies, of course, and it was blacker than black. I have never experienced such blackness. And those other two times were really difficult, but it was nothing like the loss of Joshua. And then the stuff with my father and looking at that perhaps what I believed about what happened as a kid isn't the truth, or perhaps there is another truth. And it was just very extraordinarily tough. And what I have been given is the same thing that works for the self-imposed crisis works for the other crises as well. And last week, my home group, we read a part out of the big book every week, and then we discuss it. And I don't remember where it is, but it is in We Agnostics. And there's a story about a guy who has the suicide and all these awful, awful things happen in his life. And I've read it a whole bunch of times, and I didn't hear it with the ears that I heard it with last week. And that said, this guy's having all of these awful things happen out here, and they're extraordinarily difficult circumstances, but he goes to his creator. That's the only place that I have left to go. There's nothing that'll fix. And it is possible that things out here are very, very, very difficult, and that I can go to my creator. That is possible. And that, when I say it out loud, it sounds so simple. And of course it's possible, Marcy, but for me to realize that within is huge. So I have just been going to my creator on a not a different level, but with renewed vigor about that. And I have become grateful for those circumstances. Joshua's death has been a huge gift to me. I would absolutely love for him to be walking with me today. That is not what I'm saying, but what I am realizing is that I've also realized some about, I hesitate because I don't want to get too, anyway, just about the big gift that sobriety is, and also that it is possible, love does not die, that it is possible that just as the folks that have gone before him, and when my sponsor Valerie lost Dawn, that was a big loss to me, but and I've missed him throughout the years, but nothing like Joshua. I mean, every day, like clockwork, that guy would call me at 2 o'clock. Marcy, what are you doing? Like, bro, same thing every other American's doing. I'm at this magical thing called work. What are you doing? Go get a job, you lazy. I mean, come on. He said, I've been clean 3 days. But that's what you told me yesterday, you damn dirty liar. And then I say, you know, bro, I know you're lying. And I love you. You don't have to lie. I know you're lying. And I love you tremendously. I want you to know that it's okay to tell me the truth. But if you need to lie, it's fine too. Because either way, I love you. And by me saying that, I've gotten to also realize that these lies, whether they're through withholding something or blatantly lying to the people I love the most, like my sponsor and my husband, are absolutely unnecessary. Just like Joshua's lies were totally unnecessary in my life. And I might have gotten that gift had he lived, but I have definitely received it through his passing. And his funeral, I want to talk a little bit about that because I've heard some horrible stories about when people lose loved ones because of this disease and what an awful, awful, not that his death was beautiful, but I tell you, it was in a lot of ways. On Friday night after my home group business meeting, I got a call from my older sister Marion, my older sister Joy, and my older brother Christopher. Joy and Christopher are the two that I drank with originally. Tell me about that I need to come down to Henrico Doctors because Joshua's in ICU. Marion and I were actually on the phone, and she was hysterical, and I thought, it's not that big of a deal. Calm down. I mean, he's probably going to be fine. I mean, it just didn't register. ICU is very serious. Marion said, it's not okay. I'm not okay. And I said, chicken, here's the deal. Even if it's not okay, we're going to be okay. Haven't we said that 1,000 times? That it may not be okay, but you will be okay. You will be okay. If you walk with your Creator, if you trust your Creator, and allow people to love you and to be loved, you will be okay. So when on Friday night he passed, and then he was declared deceased on Sunday, because I'm not a medical person. I don't get all that. That'll take me half an hour to explain, but that's just the way it was. And had he passed under a different circumstance, his organs would not have been able to be used. He's the first person to be able to donate out of that hospital. And that hospital staff and those COs, because he was property of the county because he was incarcerated, were the most friendly and loving folks. When they did when the hospital performed the test to see if Joshua had basic brain function, all of the staff let us in there. They said, originally they said, well, we let just a few people in there. I said, well, your definition of a few is very different than my family's definition of a few, because when you're one of 10, a few is like 30. Keeping it under 30 is a few. We had a small wedding, my husband and I. We had 200 people there. And that was a small wedding in my family. So they let all of us come back there. And his organs were able to be used. And when we were planning his services, we said, listen, there has to be a few basic things. One is, we will not lie. We will tell the truth that he died as a result of mental illness and drug addiction, and we will make no bones about it. And my younger sister, who's a RN up in Vermont, had some things to say about that. And my brother, who's a hotshot She said, well, that's ridiculous. I'm a professional. My brother is a very big VP, very big hotshot. Said, what am I, chop liver? I mean, but what happened is the magic of the group conscience. And what's neat is that's not unusual for my family. I knew about group conscience before I came here. When my brother and sister and I moved in with my parents, they had a group conscience with their five kids. And if anyone had said that they don't want us to go live there, they wouldn't have done it, because they knew the group was more important than the whole. My aunt, my mama, locked the house and put my stuff outside because I was raising such a ruckus when I was drinking, because the group is more important than the individual. At 14 years old, she said, you can stay here as long as you want, but these are the rules. I understand they're very difficult rules. Being home by 11:30 at 14 is a tall order. So I absolutely understand if you can't pull it off, you can't live here. So I've known about the importance of the group conscience. And then I got to see that again with my family, that we won't lie. We will tell the truth. And that unity first. And that's great. I've heard that a gazillion times. And I've been your GSR at my home group. I've gotten to go to assemblies. And I've gotten to say, my home group wants to do this. I don't agree with it, but my home group wants to do this. And what changed for me is at the services, we had a Friday night service, which, as a side note, my family made the box that Joshua laid in. And then we sewed the inside. I could tell so many stories of just tremendous love and tremendous gratitude and community that I have never experienced. You came and sat with me and Friday night up at the hospital, my brother's sponsor. Mike's been sponsoring Christopher for 21 years, and Mike just held my hand all night, didn't even say a word, just held my hand. My sponsor showed up at the hospital, and home group members showed up. People that didn't even know Joshua came there because of the love that they had for us. And that's just tremendous to me. So we said unity first. And at the Saturday services for Joshua, a friend, Phil, that has just had very difficult time getting and staying sober, showed up at the services and just smelled of alcohol. And mom was having a hard time. She's putting her baby away because of this close thing. And I said, Mama, do you want me to ask him to leave? She said, no, he needs to be here. He needs to see what this does. Because she is under the same delusion that I often am, that I can scare you into sobriety. It doesn't work. In fact, in the middle of all of that, the thought to drink came on me strong. It was just weird. I'm like, seriously, this is what happens? And I've heard you talk about going through tough times and never once thinking about drinking. It came on me heavy. And I did not call my sponsor first. I said, what is happening? This is so weird. And I talked to my sister, who was right there at the services with me. And then I did call my sponsor, and she said, I don't know what to tell you, Moo. I mean, what do you say? There's nothing that she can say to talk me out of it. But it did come on me strong. And so Mama said, Phil, it's fine for Phil to say. And then we looked over again, and it was just getting harder. So one of the guys that's in NA with my brother asked him to leave. And so I got up, because I was like, man, that's ridiculous. And I talked to Phil, and he said, yeah, I've been asked to leave. And I said, Phil, you smell a lot like alcohol. He says, I haven't been drinking. I said, well, it's a little more scary then, that you smell like alcohol 3 days later since your last drink. And it's that heavy. And on the inside, I wanted to say, come on back in here with me, bro. Come on back in here. But I didn't. And I also wanted to say, I really want you to be here. I wish my family hadn't done that. But I didn't. I know unity is when I stay with what you've asked, despite what I think or feel. And I have a new understanding of that for when I am asked to be a GSR and I go to assembly and I don't agree with what the group says, but I ask that an action be taken because my group has asked it. I don't need to tell you anymore. I don't agree with what my group says. I'm asked to do what my group has asked me to do. and I'm asked to show up where I'm invited. And what a great principle that has been for me. Before Joshua died, it was like, I guess a month or two before he passed, my parents asked us to go to the 50th anniversary of the church that we grew up in. That's so stupid. It's the night of my home group. And so I call my sponsor. I'm thinking, there's no way she's going to say, yeah, that's a good idea to go. She says, Moo, it sounds like you might want to go where you're invited. And I said, but you don't understand. It's my home group. I mean, and I have in the past wanted to think of reasons to miss my home group. And I'm in a place right now where I just don't. I like to be there. I like being there half an hour early. I feel like if I'm not there half an hour early, I'm late. And if somebody introduces themselves in the meeting that I didn't introduce to before the meeting, I feel a little gypped. I mean, that's just how I am. I want to know the people that are coming to the group because I want them to be welcomed and I want them to know it's a safe place to come back to. I don't want people slipping through the cracks. Anyway, so Valerie said, no, why don't you go to that? I thought, that's retarded. So, and I said, it's the 50th anniversary of the elementary school. That's so stupid. I didn't even know what it was. It ends up, it's the 50th anniversary of the church, and there's a school attached to it, and that's where I went to elementary school. So we went and got to dance, and my family's a lot of fun to dance with. If there's music even simmering in the background, there are like four or five of us getting up to dance. It doesn't even matter. We're the first on the floor and the last off. And so Joshua was dancing with us, and I got to see some elementary school friends and teachers that I hadn't seen in years and years. And when we got home, Mama said, that was just really neat that all you kids were there, and because it's very unusual for all of us to be anywhere together. And she said, and it was kind of neat that nobody's spouses was able to go. I would have liked for the spouses to have been there, but it was neat to sit in church and have all you kids sitting the way that you used to when you were little. And then Joshua passed, and that was the last time that we all got together as a family. And I would have missed it because it made sense to me to go to my home group. So sometimes I just do what doesn't make sense. And there was something that, and I told Valerie this, I said, I really believe I should go, but I don't want to. It's so stupid. And I, quite frankly, when Valerie said, well, it sounds like you should go where you're invited, I said, honestly, I was hoping that you'd tell me to be at my home group where I'm supposed to be, because it just sounds so lame and awful. And it was great. And so maybe if I just go where I'm invited and just show up where I'm asked to be, it'll be really nice. So, one other story about the services. Joshua passed away on May 31st, and then he was declared deceased on June 2nd. And then all of these tests needed to be done by the county, an autopsy, because he was property of the county, and then the organ harvesting, and because he was able to give his organs to, I have a soft spot for the 70-year-old man that got his kidney because he likes to ride motorcycles. I got this letter. Where all the organs went, and then a pin that says organ donor family. I said, so seriously, I said to my mom, I said, seriously, my brother dies and I get a crappy pin? Are you joking me right now? Because there's like nothing for nothing from, I don't even think that he had any, any clothes, nothing. I don't know where any of that is. I was going to my parents' house during that week because we weren't able to put him to rest until that Friday night was when the services were. So it was an entire week. And we are not people that sit still. I mean, alcoholics aren't. And my family's kind of chock full of them. So that's why Joshua's box was made. And my aunts were all in town from Vermont where they all live. And so I'm going up to Mom and Daddy's, and Valerie said, listen, Moo, once you don't judge your mourning. Just be there with it. Don't judge your grief. Because I was getting so frustrated because I couldn't think straight. I just couldn't stay focused on anything. And so I had to go by the Southern States to get chicken food for my chickens, and there's this big thing of beets. And they have like a bushel of beets. I'm like, beets? That sounds nice. So I love to dicker with people. So I started dickering and negotiating a better price on, well, what if I just take them all? She's like, all right, well, you just take them all, and here's the price I'll give you. So I'm like, what am I doing with all these beets? I'm so so weird. So I go to mom and daddy's. I'm like, yeah. So in the middle of everything else that everybody has going on, I have all these beads. And my auntie looks at me, my mama's oldest sister. First, she said, thank God you have some. I'm so sick of people bringing out food for us to heat up. Thank God you have something that needs to be prepared. I was just so happy. I mean, beats coming out of the ears. But I was like, man, I am so grateful for the quiet voice within and for being willing to take action that doesn't make any sense to me. And I have had a lot of fun with my mom. She's right on the way home. So when I leave, when I leave town and come home, her house is right on the way, so sometimes I'll just get in her house, and for a long time, I'd just get in the bed with her and just lay in bed with her because she just couldn't get out of the bed. And then my siblings were like, Mama needs to get up. I'm like, no, she doesn't. She needs you to get in bed with her. Just get in the bed with her. And so Friday night, I told her I'd come up. I said, well, I'm going to stop by your house because for a long time, it was just lining up. She's an RN and has weird hours, where she literally had just pulled in the driveway and then I pull in. Or she was literally just going to bed and I pulled in. And then this past week, it just hasn't been lining up like that at all. And so I said, well, are you going to be home Friday? She said, yeah. I said, well, after my home group, I'd like to come by if it's not too late. And a dear friend of mine, Jen, was going to go out. And she said, but I really want to go out with you. And I said, well, Jen, I'm going out to Mama's house. Do you want to come with me? She said, is Mama going to make me some food? I said, I bet she will. Let me call her and see. So Mama was ecstatic to make food. She's like, I can't believe that you girls came out. We didn't get there until like 9:30. We left at 11. And I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, she needs to get up early, and I'm imposing. And she was so happy because Daddy works out of town a lot. He's out of town three weeks, usually 3.5 weeks out of the month, 3 to 3.5 weeks out of the month. So she was just so happy to have an excuse to have all the, she had nuts in the little, instead of just putting them in the can, she puts them in the container, which cracks me up. So it was just so much fun just to go and be and to be able to visit. And that's another gift that I've been given, is to visit, because I'm not somebody that sits and visits so well, and I really appreciate that. And Sam, thank you so much for letting me participate in your home group, and thanks to you, everyone.